Welcome to Truth News Radio Australia. It's the 20th of October 2011. My name is Hereward Fenton, and you're listening to an Australian-made podcast that's done on a small budget, but we try to attain a level of professionalism in what we do, and we try to get good interviews, and we try to filter the information with a degree of skepticism, while at the same time bringing you an alternative perspective on the information that you're getting from other sources. Of course, we're not perfect, and there may be cases where we fail, and there may be cases where we overstep the line, because, of course, we have our own prejudices, we have our own biases, as does every media outlet. I try to be fairly straightforward about what I think and where my bias is, and I also try to advocate for why I have a particular viewpoint, in the sense that I don't merely say, well, you know, that's just belief, or, you know, that's the way things are. I try to actually articulate why I have a view based on information, based on science, and based on reason, universal intellectual and scientific procedures for trying to understand the world. So, of course, one of the most common themes of this show that we often talk about is climate change. And I have today coming on very shortly a very important person from Australia who's contributed really original research and insights into climate change from the skeptical point of view about man-made climate change. Her name's Joanne Nova. And Joanne is very important globally as well. Her website is picked up by people all around the world. She wrote a book called The Skeptic's Handbook, and she's actually not in any way a stereotype of what you might think of, say, an anti-environmentalist person. She's been a member of the Greens, but she came up against some of the issues about climate change that she disagreed with, and with her husband, David Evans, she's basically become a really important source of alternative information. So she'll be coming on the show in about 10 minutes. Also coming on the show today, I have John Bursell, who is a regular on Truth News Radio Australia, aircraft engineer and important figure in the Australian 9/11 truth movement, and also a member of the Qantas Union. And John has been involved in industrial action against the policies at Qantas, which are bringing in major changes to the way airplanes are serviced, taking it out of the hands of the local staff, the local highly trained engineers, and putting it in the hands of overseas operators. So I'll also be getting some updates from John on that, and we'll also be talking about the way John sees the ongoing issues around the carbon tax, and also looking at the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Australia movements. Now, just quickly taking a look at some Australian news before we get on to our interview. I have a story here from the Sydney Morning Herald. Pharmacists paid by drug company for patient details. One of the world's biggest drug companies has been accused of paying Australian pharmacists to promote some of its best-selling drugs in a controversial deal that has divided the profession. Pfizer pays pharmacies a $7 administration fee for each patient signed up to so-called support programs that involve the drug company providing information directly to patients about nine of its drugs. Pharmacists say that the deal, which Pfizer struck with the Pharmacy Guild of Australia in July, is similar to the one dumped this month for them to market dietary supplements with prescription medicines. The article goes on to talk about some reasons why this is not a good thing. But to my mind, this article and subsequent articles that have come out today as well completely bypass the key issue. I mean, they're saying that this is going to encourage people to buy the branded version of a drug rather than the unbranded generic version of a drug, and that that is, you know, the main thing to be concerned about. Well, that's the least thing to be concerned about, okay? The main thing to be concerned about is that the drug manufacturers are trying to sell us drugs directly and bypassing any kind of proper medical diagnosis, and basically selling us as consumers these products that we are absolutely in no position to judge their efficacy. And it's a complete betrayal of medicine, a complete abandonment of medicine just in favor of a predatory, commercial, exploitative agenda. And, you know, there should be a revolution about that right now in the streets. This whole thing should be shut down. I mean, we should be occupying the pharmacies, because the drugging of our population and the commercialization of that is so rampant, it is so outrageous that it is actually one of the key top issues that we look at here at Truth News, and it's one that just has to be addressed. So I leave you to check that out on our show notes. Second story from Australia. What Julia Gillard will tell the nation in the event of a terrorist attack. Julia Gillard will ask Australians to remain calm and offer reassurance if terrorists attack Australian soil. According to a draft address prepared by National Security, the Prime Minister will tell the nation, "I ask the people of Australia at this time to remain calm. We should not allow terrorism to impact upon the way of life we value so highly. I wish to reassure Australians that all of Australia's governments, police forces, emergency services, security and intelligence agencies are doing all they can to prevent further attacks and help those who have been affected." Well, that's a direct quote from what the Prime Minister of Australia will tell us in the event of an attack. And it goes on to say here that the government has stated that a media blackout would be imposed only in extreme circumstances. Now, isn't that kind? They would only bring in a media blackout about information in relation to a terrorist attack under extreme circumstances. Well, gee, isn't a terrorist attack an extreme circumstance itself? And why are they trying to block information? What's all that about? Well, it says here that security guidelines seen by Fairfax Papers urge security and police to cooperate with journalists because how an incident is reported by domestic and international mass media outlets and how journalists themselves judge the actions of government agencies will shape public confidence and influence views on whether the incident is successfully resolved. Oh, shape public confidence. I mean, nothing about the reality of whether they will deal with it. They just want to shape your confidence. In other words, yes, we have to manipulate you to think that we're doing the right thing. No mention of actually the need to do the right thing. And it says here that journalists should be encouraged to get their information from government spokespeople rather than ill-informed academics or unofficial terrorism experts. And they highlight the dangers of live coverage of eyewitness accounts, which may create fear and alarm. Well, I tell you, I've got some fear and alarm at that statement in itself. The attitude of mind that would actually make a statement like that, an official statement of how the government wants to deal with a serious terrorist situation, is actually very, very alarming. I mean, we know that they've been manipulating the news forever. We know that they have denotices that they can use to stop the reporting of certain topics. But this is basically taking that to another level and basically propagandizing it. This is actually propagandizing the concept of censorship so that we come completely on board with it and don't object to it in any way, which means that in reality, the degree of control of the media is greater than what you ever even anticipated. So why? Why is the government doing this? Why are they so brazen in their attempt to suppress public information? Well, this is part of the slow but inevitable unfolding march towards tyranny. And of course, everything that's happened over the last few years with succeeding governments has indicated to us that there are agencies at work that are bringing forth a new form of much harsher totalitarian style governance to this country. And of course, the carbon tax is yet another example of that. And as one of my previous guests on the show said, lying about it, lying about how they were going to bring in the carbon tax, saying there will be no carbon tax, and then having an election, and then saying, well, we changed our mind now. That is another example of totalitarianism. And everything indicates to me that the current situation that we are moving towards, with increasing international instability with the financial systems and the Occupy movements springing up all around the world in this amazing orchestrated pattern, with a clear collectivist redistribution kind of theme running through them, suggests that this is actually the agenda of those who want to bring about the new system. So we've got to really wake up. We've got to really start communicating. We've got to really actually get involved, because there is an opportunity with the amount of turmoil that we have at the moment. But as I said in the last show, and as I'm going to bring up shortly in my discussion with Joanne Nova, there is a separation of the left and right, which is co-opted and which is creating depriving the movements of any real force. The Occupy movements have become completely caught up in the left-wing green left mantra, and those massive numbers of people who turned out to protest against the carbon tax have just disappeared. But we know they're out there. We know the carbon taxes are going to carbon protests are going to come back. But unfortunately, this separation of our society into opposing camps is something that only feeds the power structure itself. So again, I'm going to try in my shows to see how can we neutralize this? How can we break the impasse that basically allows this to occur? So going to break now, and we're going to come back with our interview with Joanne Nova very shortly. Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to the show. Well, as promised, I have, for a very brief time today, I have on the line Joanne Nova, who is, of course, very well known to a lot of people and probably needs no introduction, although what I've found with the alternative media these days is, even though there can be huge followings around certain people and certain websites, because this information doesn't get into the mainstream, a lot of people are not actually aware of the information until someone tells them about it. So if this is the first time you're hearing about Joanne Nova, I recommend very strongly go to the website, look at joannenova.com.au, check it out, and you'll have an amazing experience and a lot to learn from the website, the Skeptics Handbook that she's put together, and you'll understand why so many people have actually gathered around that site for information and breaking news about climate change and climate change skepticism. Joanne, welcome to Truth News Radio Australia.
Hello, how are you?
I am great, great. I'm just, basically at war. You know, I'm in an info war, Joanne. And
we're great, but the country's going to pieces. It's a shame about that.
It's a huge, sad and tragic situation. The passing of the carbon tax last week was a really dark, dark moment in our history. And, of course, it's only been passed through the lower house. It still has to go through the Senate, but apparently that's a done deal. I wonder, Joanne, if you could maybe just begin by, can you give us any ray of hope that this can actually be rolled back? What's your best guess about the possibility of rolling this back?
Well, I'm an optimist, so I believe one way or another truth will out and we will see this silly policy removed. I guess worst case scenario is we have to wait for another 2 years for an election, and then of course we hope that the a party who wants to get rid of this is wins the election, and that it can afford to unwind it. I mean, it is quite scary, and it's incredibly anti-democratic comments from people like Combe to say that Abbott can't rewind this, and he knows it. I mean, to me, this is the core of democracy. Isn't the idea supposed to be that we, the people, get to vote on an option some point in the future? And before anybody says that we voted on it in 2007, which is the weak excuse put forward by those who want it these days,
yes,
Howard never promised to bring it in, except with the caveat that the other nations around the world were doing it. Now, those kind of caveats are really important. And to ignore the fact that Howard said, yes, we'll bring in an ETS, assuming that the rest of the world does it, is to ignore the whole meaning of what we voted for and what he did. So, you know, it's a ridiculous idea to say that we wanted an emissions trading scheme, that the Australian people want it, that we get it, and that we can't change our minds even if we did vote for it in 2007. We didn't in 2010.
Well, it's also extremely underhanded and, you know, it's sort of Machiavellian. It shows another kind of level of deception to which the people who are running this are willing to go. To first of all say, look, there will be no carbon tax under a government I lead, have an election, change your mind, and then engineer it so sneakily so they can say, well, guess what, you won't be able to reverse this either. It's unbelievable.
You know, this is one of the really sad things about this, that I think we would have been better off if the Labor Party had have won outright at the last election instead of being so crippled that they were willing to break any promise, to stand for nothing, to achieve government, to do it with people who have largely conservative electorates, who turned their own back on their own electorates to do that, and, yes, to break promises. To me, from beginning to end, this is the mark of desperation rather than any Machiavellian tactics. I don't think anyone was driving this from the beginning. I don't think Julia Gillard really wanted an emissions trading scheme. I think she just saw it in the end, supposedly with her poor political judgment that she seems to be showing, as being her way of making a mark, of getting legislation through that she might achieve a poll bounce for. And, you know, it's as crazy as that. I really don't think that anybody has been desperately trying and plotting chess moves way in advance to get this legislation through like this. I think we've just stumbled, unluckily, through an array of bad decisions.
That's an extraordinary viewpoint. I tend to think you're right, because I can see that that a lot of these things seem to have happened almost randomly. But in history, you know, Joanne, when you look back at when periods of tyranny have enveloped societies, it tends to happen that way. Tyranny tends to come upon you through the weaknesses of people rather than their strengths.
Yes. I agree with that. And I think the underlying problem that the Labor Party faces is not one of accidentally not getting another four seats at the last election. It's one of the fact that it's lost its policies, its principles, its philosophies, and its membership in the last 10 or 15 years. And it needs to rediscover those things so that it can start representing the workers again instead of this kind of inner city minority group who really are Greens voters anyway.
Absolutely. And I know from your presentation that I saw down in Sydney, you used to be a member of the Greens, is that right?
I did. It's the only political party I've ever been a member of, so I can truly say that I've been across the spectrum. I worked actively, I campaigned and I fundraised for the Greens in the 90s, and I thought I was doing a useful thing then. My disappointment came when, I guess as we grew up and were exposed to other ideas, I could see that ultimately there were no good answers coming from that side of the spectrum. You know, I would meet conservative people who would ask me good questions, or Austrian economists who would point out decent things, and I had no answer. And when I searched on the left for answers, neither did they. And the level of debate is just so poor in this country that there's a vacuum, an intellectual vacuum, and they end up resorting to name-calling, deniers. You know, that's the comeback in a scientific debate.
Absolutely. When did you first become active in what you're doing now? Like, when did you first become a dissident voice?
Well, the interesting thing is, I thought that we should be worried about CO2. I even spoke on the ABC as a science presenter and said we should worry about carbon dioxide. And it wasn't until 2007 when my husband, who was working for the Australian Greenhouse Office at the time and had been following the science, came to me one day and said, you know, there is no evidence for the great global warming theory. And I said, you must be kidding. Of course there is. And what about the Vostok ice cores? And I was blown away, not so much by the fact that within 5 minutes he could completely trounce that piece of information, but that I had not already read that. It was the media vacuum which really shocked me more than any of the scientific documents out there. I mean, I had no idea at that stage that the famous Vostok ice cores that Al Gore used in his movie and which have been repeated ad infinitum everywhere, I had no idea that the correlation in that, where you see temperature rise and fall and CO2 rise and fall together, was due to temperature pushing CO2 up and CO2 rising 800 years after temperature. I mean, you can't see an 800-year delay in a graph that goes back 500,000 years. So I was shocked that not only was there an 800-year delay and it was backwards, CO2 was pulled up by temperature and dropped down eventually by temperature too, that had not been reported in magazines like New Scientist and Discover magazine and Cosmos magazine, Scientific America. You can list them all off. And they won't touch a story like that, and except for 4 or 5 years later, they covered how, you know, well, it was just a myth that point mattered. The myth, the point that they'd never cover, because it was so important they couldn't cover it, then they try to pretend it was a myth.
That is the sad state of the media, of course. And, you know,
media are crucial to this. So, you know, good on you, Richard, for doing something which is counter to that. We so need the alternative media, thank God, for the internet.
Now, can you, Joanne, can you recommend one source of information? There are so many sources of information on this. And honestly, it is so confusing for anyone. And I often have conversations about this with people who are totally confused. And, you know, there are so many sources of information that it's hard to find one source where you can say, let's just go through a checklist. Let's go through a checklist of the best evidence and the best reasons not to say the debate is over, not to say that, yes, there is a catastrophic human-induced climate change caused by CO2. Is there any one particular place you would recommend to go to grab that? I mean, obviously your website, but of course your website is a blog format. Anything else you would just recommend off the cuff?
Well, it's difficult, and even my website has something like 620 articles on it, so it's difficult to find the few that you need to read to not be swamped with information. If you start with the Skeptics Handbook 1 and 2, that gives you a big summary of where things are at and a lot of the background to the debate. And I do have a page for people who are new and also a point to click for my favourite posts. But ultimately it comes back to logic and reason, and when it comes down to it, this is now between two groups, one who are independent scientists, that's the skeptics, who have got empirical evidence, and the other group who are government-funded scientists, the establishment, who call us names, who call us deniers, and who, when it comes down to it, only have models and not empirical evidence. And this is what science is all about.
Joanne, we're just going to break. I know you're very limited time. Any chance of one more segment with you, a short segment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we're just going to go straight to break and then be back. Nick Drake with Clothes of Sand.
Who has dressed you in strange clothes of sand? Who has taken you far from my land? Who has said that my sayings are wrong? And who will say that I stayed much too long? Clothes of sand have covered your face, given you meaning, taken my place. So make your way on down to the sea. Something has taken you so far from me. Does it now seem worth all the color of skies to see the earth through painted eyes? Glass, see the stains of winter's grass. Can you now return to from where you came? Try to burn your changing name, or with silver spoons and colored light, will you worship moons and winter's night? Clothes of sand have covered your face, given you meaning, taken my place. So make your way on down to the sea. Something has taken you so far from me.
Welcome back to the show. Today I'm talking to Joanne Nova, the webmaster and editor of joannenova.com.au, really important website for the climate skeptics in Australia and internationally, and gets a lot of scientists posting on there. Of course, Joanne's husband is a scientist, one of the top scientists who was working for the government. Now, Joanne, important points there you made about using logic, and I do agree one has to actually use one's capacity to reason to understand that you're having the wool pulled over your eyes. And I don't think any information that you could pull out of your back pocket is ultimately going to work better than being able to use logic and reason effectively. But I must say, even I have trouble doing it when faced with people who have been indoctrinated with the mass media version of what's going on. For example, you know, if you talk about, well, you know, the climate, and talk about the temperature, and you say to people, well, you know, gee, it's really cold today, and it's like it's October, and they go, yeah, but it's going to get warm soon, and then you say, well, gee, but it's, you know, it's late October, and it's been so cold, and you know, they say that the planet's burning up with global warming, and I mean, I sometimes do this just chatting to people, you know what I mean, and quite often I get the knee jerk reaction, and they go, oh, but don't you know there was a heat wave in Spain last year. And they instantly pull something out that's actually amazing, because they have this information in their head that there was a heat wave here and a heat wave there, and that, you know, just because it's cold today doesn't mean the global warming isn't real. And of course, I would say, yes, that's right. But just because there was a heat wave doesn't mean it's real either. I mean, that cuts both ways. But it's still very hard to have the, I guess, for people don't seem to actually be able to do the reasoning themselves to see that it's actually not really getting warmer realistically. I mean, I've been living in Sydney for a long time, 20 years, and I guarantee you it is not significantly warmer here. Like, it was warmer for a few years. We all know that. There were some warm years. Late 90s were warmer. And the last few years have been pretty cool.
Well, yeah, Richard, look, I actually try and
Harrowwood, actually. Yeah. Sorry.
Harrowwood.
Yeah.
Sorry, Harrowwood.
No, you're right.
I've done that before, haven't I? I've got it back to front.
You're
sorry,
fine.
Harrowwood.
Yeah.
I avoid the arguments mostly about rising temperatures over the last 15 years because it is a rabbit hole you can disappear into, and ultimately it doesn't really make, to me, a convincing, conclusive case either way. Firstly, when you're talking to people who believe in the theory of global warming, the first point is mostly it's a religious belief, and it's very difficult to reason with anyone who didn't get into this through reason. They're not going to get out of it through reason necessarily either. With those kind of people, to be honest, if I'm sitting next to a green on the plane, and remember I used to be one, there are lots of good people who are greens, they just haven't necessarily met the intellectual arguments that have come from the other side. And some green aims are good. I still want to protect the environment too, I might add, but it doesn't matter how many wind farms you build, it isn't going to stop our topsoil from washing away. I think we need to get back to proper green aims instead of these kind of fake ones. The point I make with most of the Greens is the argument that, did you know the banks want us to trade carbon? And I simply ask them questions. Rather than me trying to give them all the information that I can download from my head, I'm asking them questions. Did you know that the banks want us to trade carbon? It's a way, it's an opener. And no, they weren't aware that the global trading markets for carbon were $144 billion turned over last year. That if they got global trading, it would be a $2 trillion market. And to put that in perspective, that would make it the largest market, commodity market in the world, which is all the more impressive given that carbon is not a commodity. It is trading pieces of paper that are ruled by government fiat, that there's no product that exists. If someone gives you a fake certificate, how can you tell it from a real one? The whole point with that is that it's an enormous financial industry running in the background. There were $243 billion invested in renewables last year. So all this talk of big oil, I mean, sure, oil is very big. Fossil fuels is a powerful lobbying industry. But does anyone kid themselves that on the other side of the fence, we have got whole UN agencies like the IPCC, like the meteorological organisations, like the UNEP. We've got the UN itself fighting for this kind of thing. And we've got government departments like the Department of Climate Change. We've got Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Barclays Bank, HSBC, Deutsche Bank. They're lobbying on Congress and other places to try and get carbon trading around the world. I mean, no matter how big fossil fuel is, it doesn't live or die on a carbon tax. Sure, it doesn't want a carbon tax, but actually it isn't going to make that much difference to it because it can pass the costs on to consumers. All of the people in the fossil fuel industry will be hit. And let's face it, there's no real alternatives to using fossil fuels at the moment anyway. So we consumers are going to be buying their products regardless. So it's not really that big a high priority for the fossil fuel industry to get rid of this, whereas for, say, wind farms, they live and die depending on whether we get carbon trading. If there is no carbon subsidy, they simply can't operate. I mean, wind at best is two or three times as expensive as coal. That's at best. Solar at best is about five or six times as expensive, and at worst it's something like 10 times as expensive per unit of energy. So, you know, they can't compete. Those industries must get carbon trading, and they are lobbying for everything to get it.
Just on the question of the viability of moving off fossil fuels, I did some interviews on Saturday, and I was down at the Occupy Martin Place event, the Occupy Wall Street, which is now Occupy Australia here. And I've got a dialogue there that I had with a lady from the Green Left, a Green Left weekly newspaper. And it's worth a watch, actually. And, I encourage everyone, well, everyone on this show has probably listened to it, but you might want to take a look at it, because she actually says that she believes that there's a group called Beyond Zero, I believe it's called, which has developed a plan for moving completely to renewables, 100%. Can you, and I was a bit taken aback because I didn't think anyone was so radical or so ridiculous as to assume that we could do that. But this lady who was manning this particular stall insisted that that's all been sorted by this Beyond Zero organization.
No, it's incredible. And whenever anyone mentions solar, you just have to ask them, can you name one solar running generator in the world that's running at equivalent cost to coal? And the answer is not even close. No one can name one. They can all name ones that are in development. They can all name ones that are going to be started. But people have been doing that since 1970. And what happens to these giant solar plans that are going to be marvellous and all wonderful is that in the end they don't perform the way people hoped they would, and then it all goes quiet and we never quite hear what happens to the giant solar plant that was going to save the world that didn't. So ask them questions. Ask them to name a solar plant that works, and they can't. Ask them if they understand what kind of capacities we're getting out of solar and wind, and do they realise that we're looking at 25% capacity, 20% capacity for those powers, which means if they say that they're 1,000 megawatt generators, what we get off them is more like 250 megawatts. Or less, and that solar power simply obviously can't generate at night, although they did that in Spain for a while. Did you know about that?
Right, so they did generate power.
Yeah, they discovered that people were generating solar power at night in Spain.
That is interesting.
They were paying such rich subsidies there for solar-powered energy that the market does what the market does, and it went and bought diesel generators, plugged them into their solar power rooftop panels, and voila, they generated the solar at night time. And someone finally got onto looking at it and discovered the photovoltaic was really diesel voltaic and busted that fraud.
And, of course, people were just paying for it because the price was... Yeah,
the taxpayers of Spain paid for solar-powered electricity at night time. It's just crazy.
Look, just in the time that we've got left, Joanne, I just want to talk briefly about the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Australia. We were talking earlier about it. You expressed a degree of cynicism about the possibility that the people who are the climate skeptics, those who actually, which are the vast majority of Australians, I mean, 80% in polls, 90%, I mean, it's really high, are against it. We've got this supposed movement, which is democratic, trying to fix the banking system. And as you've pointed out, the carbon taxes are a banking scam. So, is there a possibility, or do you think it's just too divided for the Occupy Australia to somehow, I guess, get educated or to join up with this massive movement of people who wants the carbon tax rolled back?
Look, I would love it to see, and I don't know if there's anyone who exists who could do it, but who could come and join together, because there is a legitimate protest on both sides. We have become financially controlled in the sense that the financial markets occupy such a big slice of our national kind of, you could call it GDP, but it's so much larger than it was 30 years ago. And the financial sector really doesn't deserve to control that much of our economy. And the problems that we're getting, the market crashes, were all foreseeable and predicted a long time ago by people watching things like monetary aggregates and monetary supply. And so I can see there's a legitimate complaint coming out of both the Occupy Wall Street, which kind of fits with the Tea Party as well. We're both you know, we don't want these big payouts, these bailouts going to the giant bankers. But what I see also on the Occupy Wall Street side is that they haven't thought through the system, the way our currency is based. They don't understand the problems. There isn't that intellectual wherewithal to figure out how to sort them out. It's just a stand up and yell, this is wrong and we don't like it kind of attitude, which isn't ultimately going to solve any problem, because you need to know what causes it in order to be able to fix it. So, yeah, it would be great if we had a spokesman who could stand up in front of that crowd and say, people, we want power for the people, and that power has to come through votes, through hard work, through rewarding people who work hard instead of government handouts and fake things. And, look, if there was someone like that, it would be just brilliant, but I don't know that anyone could do it.
Yeah, it would need to be a messianic figure, I think, who could bring people together on that level.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think that's what it comes down to. People on the left often turn their heroes into messiahs, unfortunately, for them.
Sadly. Look, we've come to the end of this segment. Look, I'll let you go. Thanks so much for coming on today. Really excellent talking to you.
Great talking to you too, Herowood. Thank you.
sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to the show. Now, unfortunately, I was unable to get John Bursell on the line. He's been called off because he's actually at work at the moment. So I actually organized another interview, and very lucky, in fact, to get this interview. I'm actually speaking to Steph, who is down at Martin Place, and he is actually part of the Occupy Martin Place protest, which is ongoing. And of course, we covered it and you saw the video that we did, but I've actually had a chance to talk to some more people who've been there and to run past them some of my concerns that I've actually had about the movement appearing to be run by the Green Left. Certainly, if you look at the way they position themselves and with the signs and with the flyers that were going around and just the general atmosphere, it looked like it was very much a sort of a Green Left Socialist Alliance type of event. Now, I've just been speaking to Steph, and Steph, welcome to Truth News Radio Australia.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, look, great to have you on the show. Now, Steph, if you could just maybe pick up from where you left off, you were saying to me before that you think that the presence of some of these groups is part of the controlled opposition and not the real grassroots of what's going on down there.
Well, let me tell you, the people that are sleeping in the cold, on the concrete, without tents, the ones that are getting the clean water and providing the food for the homeless, and the ones that are keeping the place clean and keeping the energy up by playing the music and discussing with people and listening to them, not trying to sell them newspapers, they're the real people there. The other people are still stuck in this left-right paradigm. They're still stuck in last century's ideas of isms.
Yeah.
They don't realize that all isms came from the same place, and it was just a spectrum of thought that you were allowed to have and gives you the thought that you have in the free speech, but within the parameters of all isms.
Absolutely.
I've spoken my mind because these people come after lunch, set up their stalls, dilute our message with irrelevant propaganda, and then they make sure that they've got enough people at the General Assembly to not get completely kicked out of there, and then they go back home.
Okay.
So this to me is repugnant. And I've had to deal with this all my life. With little people who have small egos and need to get into these little groups in their universities where they're taught the lies from our masters that truth is relative, there's no, that beauty is subjective, right is wrong, and all this deconstructionist crap that we get taught as truth today.
Yeah.
And it's just no matter how much you try and explain to them that we are here firstly and foremost to support people who are occupying Wall Street. Secondly, we're here to end the process of our corporate elite buying our politicians that enact legislation to enslave us. That is what is coming out of New York. We respect the people from New York, and that's what we're doing. Now, these people come and they're trying to get people to sell badges and all these things. And unfortunately, it's hard for you to convince someone who's blind. Someone who's been indoctrinated with lies from the moment they open their eyes. The truth, you have to find the truth by yourself in life. Nobody can force you to find the truth if you're not ready to find the truth. These people genuinely think that they own morality, they own truth, they own ethics, and in my experience, left-wing academic intellectuals have no problem disassociating any facts from their mind that don't suit their agenda, and if you keep persisting, they'll make those facts illegal.
Right, Right. Look, it's really encouraging to hear what you're saying, because you're speaking reason. You're speaking truth, my friend. It's really important.
Can I just add something there? I estimated almost 4 hours a day over like a 15-year period of study. So I've read a lot more than most university students are ever going to read in their lives.
Sure.
So it's hard for me to sit there and accept the things that they say when I see a hammer and sickle, basically to me that means mass genocide. And when I said that to the crowd in one of the general meetings, that I don't want hammers and sickles here because to me that represents mass genocide, there was a gasp in the audience. And I said, relax, all you defenders of free speech.
Indeed, indeed. And how is that going down? I mean, do you think that the influences that you're talking about from these groups, the communists who are there as well? I mean, I spoke to a lady from the Communist Party as well as the Green Left. I don't know how many supporters they had. I suspect they just injected themselves into the group. They might not have many. Do you think that they're actually influencing the group, or is it just that they're trying to, but hopefully they're just obviously one small part of it?
They definitely are influencing the group, firstly on an individual level because they're trying to satisfy their own egotistical needs for microphone time.
Okay.
So on an individual level, yes. And also as a political group levels, they are causing us problems because they're diluting the potency of our message. So basically, for the first time in 6,000 years, people have finally woken up to who the real enemy is.
Okay.
So these people are sitting there, and when we talk to people, they all agree that what is happening is very wrong. But as soon as they see any ism, they immediately are repulsed. So when you're sitting there talking about this right and this right and this individual right and this individual right, that's diluting our message. And people are asking us, what are you here? And I have to sit there and correct these people and be articulate enough to persuade people that, no, these people do not represent the movement, but because we believe in free speech, we're allowing them to be here, but we have been pushing them aside. So we've created our space, and we're allowing them to have a little bit of space outside that space where they're allowed to keep promoting the garbage that didn't work for the last 200 years.
Now, Steph, just a question about what you see is actually going on in New York, because I've been doing my own research on it, and it looks to me as if there are similar things going on over there as well. There's been a lot of talk of communist presence in these organizations, and also talk within those groups that one of the main demands of the group is wealth redistribution, collectivist thinking, again, predominant, that there should be wealth redistribution and higher taxes. And those, of course, are clear signs of a big government statist collectivist approach to the problem. Do you see that happening in the American movement as well? And what do you think about that?
Okay. Firstly, I think that's something that the media in America has portrayed.
Right.
Secondly, I have no doubt that there are people there trying to infiltrate the movement. But if we look at all movements and all revolutions throughout history, they have been infiltrated very quickly and steered in a direction that suited the money masters. So I am not in New York. I have been listening to interviews from people who are saying we're trying to not be co-opted. The thing that I think is very intelligent from people like Kevin Zeese that I'm hearing is that, all right, we've studied your techniques on how you use social media and the dissidents in other countries to cause the Velvet Revolution, the Rose Revolution, and all these things, and we're here to turn these tricks back on your head.
Right.
That is my understanding of the truth of that movement. Now, are people trying to infiltrate it? Of course. Every social movement, if it hasn't been created by them, if it's genuinely been something that's been created outside their influence, it's been infiltrated so quickly that it becomes irrelevant.
Okay, so from where you're sitting, do you think your movement is strong? Is it actually does it have integrity from where it stands at the moment? How bad is the infiltration from your point of view? Can you deal with it? Do you think
the infiltration is happening every day?
Yeah.
So here we have people who are shrieking that we're suppressing their freedom of speech, who go around taking our signs down, which someone is a libertarian, and write Google Ron Paul.
Right.
So here again we have the left-wing intellectual hypocrisy of the double standard of don't oppress our freedom of speech, but if we don't agree with you, we will go out of our way and use every dirty trick we have to oppress your freedom of speech. So we're really trying to battle that. So in order to battle that, we need to get real working class people down there. So when I watch RT or Press TV, which are really covering these events, and I'm looking at the people on the streets, they don't look like left-wing intellectual university students who are doing second-year art degrees.
Yeah.
They look like workers, truck drivers, grandpas and grandpas who are losing their pensions, university students who have just been saddled with $90,000 of debt and they're about to go work at McDonald's. So at this point in time, we are fighting and waiting for the general population who is feeling the pain, the guys that are working 60, 70 hours a week and don't have time to even take a crap so they can feed their families. Once we get an injection of people like that, these little groups will see how irrelevant they are and they'll be embarrassed to be there. But at the moment, we've got a slight majority over them, and we're making better connections with the people. So the people that come and talk to us, we're engaging with them, we're listening to them, we're telling them what we think is wrong about corporate corruption and political corruption and our need as citizens to be responsible and take part in our democratic process, and they're understanding that. So when they're going past all these little socialist groups or whatever, they're not really buying the papers, they're not talking too much to them, they're just being put off and moving on.
We're going to have to leave it there, Steph. We just ran out of time. What you just said was really important, really excellent. I want to talk to you more about this, and feel free to contact me anytime. I'd like to be a mouthpiece for you. I think what you're doing is really important, and I hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a lovely evening.
You too.
We will win.
I hope so. Thanks.
Bye-bye.